for my people in the front, in the noiseblade section.
Hello and welcome to Brab Talk. This is a weekly-ish motorcycle podcast where we talk about motorcycles, life, the universe, and everything. I am your host, Shaheen Elvandi. And sitting in front of me is the handsome, knowledgeable, got his beanie cap on because it's a little bit colder today, even though it's fucking spring, Quentin Wilson. Quentin, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am lovely. It's Thursday night, which is, as T-Man just told you downstairs, it's my Friday because I'm about to hop in a van with my bestie, Mr. Tammer, and we're going to take our little motorbikes down to the world-famous longest racetrack on the West Coast.
Is
it the one? I think it's the longest racetrack in the country.
No.
Thunderhill?
No. Well, unless they, I guess.
Well, I mean, when they combine
they
together.
They have glommed it all together.
Yeah,
maybe?
So there's
I don't know.
East
I've never
and
been
there's
on
West.
It.
And when they put them together, it's 5 miles.
Oh, wow. Then it is pretty
which,
long.
Which, like, I feel like sure. I need a GPS mount for my phone.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about later. So, yeah, we're going to be going to T-Hill.
East. And is it a combined thing where you're going to be running a full 5 mile?
Fuck no, dude. I have ADD. I will get lost. I will probably need like one of those like signal guns.
Poof. Yeah.
Come get me. I don't know where I am. No, I think it's T-Hill East, which is the 3 mile track.
The normal sort of
big
that
bike,
is the one
big,
that I
would bike friendly one. Yeah.
Started racing at in like 1999.
Back in the day when I was a young whippersnapper or a Skippy. Were you a Skippy then?
Oh yeah, that was definitely Skippy days. But I never have ridden the other.
I haven't
one.
Either. Typically, when I'm there, there is like a car club.
Yeah,
drifting,
which
and
would
making
make sense,
noise.
Right? That you then that's it. One of the smart things that these tracks
so
do.
So those of you who've been to T-Hill will get this, and you Q as well. The first time I rode T-Hill, you know, they're giving us instructions, and I'm like, I've never been here, so what should I look for? And they're like, oh yeah, when you're coming up turn 9.
Blind, one of the blind.
One of the, was, like, you it, you know,
there's like
the backside of it.
Blindish.
Yep. But this particular blind one, if you stay on the right side of it, you will more than likely end up in the dirt.
Like 100%.
Yeah.
It is
so
one of the worst ones. It's
horrible.
Awesome. It's super good.
It's awesome. If you hit it right, like my Street Fighter wheelies all the way down that hill.
It's such a good thing.
I'm not even a good wheeler, but I'm like, yay.
Yeah, you don't have to be because it literally just does it.
It just does it for
you.
It
drops away. Like any of these videos you see of Jack Miller or specifically there was a good video of Alex Rins on the Yamaha at Portimao. Or not Portimao, whatever. One of the race tracks.
Is this racing one? Oh, no, that's Portimao.
Yeah, Portimao.
They do a normal wheelie.
You just, by virtue of you cresting the hill, it's wheeling all the way down the hill. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It feels really cool, especially because you're not doing it on purpose.
You're just like, I am badass.
Oh, I'm wheeling. Look at me.
So when you're going down that, there is they call it a water tower. This is not a fucking tower.
Yeah.
It's like a water
That's what
flat.
You got to look at. Yeah, that's right.
So the first like 3 or 4 laps, I'm going down this thing and I'm like, what the fuck is this tower everybody talks about?
No, it's just a boop.
It's a boop.
Is it a bleep boop?
It's like a bleep boop at the end of the, like, in the horizon.
Yeah.
And then at, like, 140 miles an hour, you're like, oh, that thing. And then when you aim at it, you have this perfect line going down this thing. Then you can concentrate on being rims and wheeling down this bitch.
Yeah.
But the first time I did it, I'm like, there is dirt an inch away from my tire.
Yeah,
I need to not be here right now. What the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? So, super excited to go to the Carter's, quote-unquote, season opener. It's going to be a brisk 45 degrees in the morning and like get to like the mid 60s.
It'll be nice.
It's going to be nice. I'm so excited for it.
I'm jealous. It's awesome.
It's, you know, got to dust the cobwebs off
Which
a little
bike?
Bit. Street Fighter.
The purpley-ish.
The purpley-ish. Yeah. The that's the Grissini Racing color, sir.
Okay. Whatever. Yeah.
The Marquez brothers are all about that now. I feel like someone somewhere looks at my bike and goes, wait a minute. I've seen this color before.
Yeah, I'd be like, Fabio Di Giannantonio, 2023.
Right.
It's awesome.
That's it.
It's cool.
That's it. We'll even give Martin some.
Sure.
He had it last year.
Yeah, well.
Hashtag Pecco versus Martin. Remember the bullshit that they created last year? Fucking Dorna, man. You guys are hilarious.
Did they try that? I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was in Spain, they were like, make sure you write hashtag Pecco versus Martin for the drama.
Whatever. I mean, it's still that way, which is awesome.
Moto Jepe, more like Moto Jepe. What are you guys doing over here? God damn it. I kid. I love MotoGP.
Uh-huh.
All right. So, doing that. Pretty excited about it. it's that time of year. Everywhere the flowers are blooming and spring is here. And good. We had Nowruz that happened last week. And so,
as long as there's no snow on the Siskiyous as you're heading down.
Don't. I don't want it.
Yeah.
We're in a big four-wheel drive Sprinter.
The only issue is that they might, that's one of the only places in Oregon that they actually salt. I'm not saying they do it like East Coast style, but they do salt. So then it's like, oh, man.
You got to wash this shit.
Right? Yeah, you have to pay attention to it. It sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Cool.
Super psyched about it. Yep. Carter's on the track. Hopefully Mr. Dave Moss will be there to make fun of my motorcycle for me again. The world famous Dave Moss.
Why is he famous?
He's a well-regarded suspension guy. And he goes to these West Coast track days.
Does he have an accent?
I believe he's a Kiwi.
I think I remember this dude. Okay.
Balded a guy.
He was a Northern California.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
He worked on my Street Fighter for me last year. You know,
he twiddled the knobs.
He's great. You pay him $60 and he will spend a lot of time on your motorcycle to get it just right for you.
Awesome.
And he's one of those guys who can look at your tire and be like, yo, your rear's wearing out because of blah, blah, blah. And your front's wearing out because of blah, blah, blah. Adjust your air, adjust your suspension. And he does all that for you, which is awesome. For $60, it's a great service. But last year, I gave him the bike. He worked on it. He's like, go to a session. Do 75%. Come back. So I went out there and I gave it 75%, I guess. Came back. He looked at it.
What weird thing.
I know.
Yeah.
And then like he, you know, fiddle fucked it a little bit.
Don't go over 75%.
Don't. 76%.
Ooh.
76% is a no-no.
I'm not going to be able to tell what's happening.
That's the no-no zone. I don't fuck with that shit. So came back. He looked at it. He's like, okay, your rear tire, you got to drop the pressure 2 pounds and let me do this, that, and the other. So I go out there, give it another 75%. Newsflash, y'all. 75% is all I got at the track. So.
That's funny.
So I go give it my all. Just 75%.
Yeah, right.
And I come back and he's like, hey, let me have your bike during lunch. I'm going to take the electronic bits off of it.
Oh.
And like, it's like he gets in there.
Oh.
So he really fiddle fucks with it. Post lunch, grab the bike from him.
Electronic,
the little adjusters that are on the top of the
forks. Oh, so that he could
forks.
Do, yeah, got it.
I don't know. He probably just takes that off and
well, he might not be able to access the spring preload without
probably.
It. Some, whatever. Probably. I can't remember. Thank God. I don't
yeah.
remember what
yeah,
that
that's
shit
not,
is.
Yeah, you work with Harleys
that.
Now, sir.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Anyways, post lunch, I go back. He's like, all right, mate, go out there, ride the piss out of it.
Ooh, this is 100%er.
And come back. And I was like, in my head, I'm like, that's still 75%.
It's going to be the same.
Still 75%, Dave. It's all I got.
But whatever.
So I go out there, give it, you know, my all. Had a pretty great run. Come back. And I'm like, it's still bottoming out. So what was happening is my front end was bottoming out. Hmm. Like the little ring that he put on there was like.
Yeah, yeah. All the way to the bottom.
Pretty much. Like,
and
like
he had tried to add
inch.
Some prelude, and,
yeah.
but it wasn't
so
working.
The whole thing, and I come back, and he just looks at it, and he's like, how does the bike feel? I'm like, the bike actually feels shockingly fine. It's not bouncy. It's progressive.
Yeah, sure.
Feels good. He goes, perfect. You're okay. It's just bottoming out because this bike's not made for you. Either you lose 60 pounds or you get new springs. And I just looked at my best friend. He was like, oh, Dave just told you to lose weight, you fat fuck.
That's interesting that he found. Like, well, I mean, it's not. That makes sense.
I mean, I'm 240 pounds.
Normally, the Ducati stuff is so oversprung. You're 240?
Uh-huh.
Wow. Okay. Not blowing smoke up Shaheen's patoot, but he doesn't look 240. So I'm actually surprised. But yeah, there's a point where, and I don't know what that break point is, but 200 pounds is generally about the max for Japanese and Italian bikes, because that's not what Japanese and Italian people are.
No.
So they end up being, but they are often
so
overstiff.
They eat so much goddamn spaghetti, and they can still be less than me.
Yeah, it's God pretty damn. Impressive, all the carbs, right? But here we have
spaghetti. We have spaghettes.
And at least we're down in some carbs there, right?
You know. For racing.
So I have seen this over and over and over and over and over. There's that break point of spring rates. And if those who are listening, this is a notable thing. Things that you can modify on your bike that actually make a huge difference.
Yeah.
And spring rates, front and rear, not just the front, make a gigantic difference.
Huge.
And depending on how hard you ride, where you ride, whatever you're doing, whether it's dirt or street or whatever, this is a thing that I feel not enough people pay attention to, and it changes the experience of a motorcycle markedly with even just a couple of turns.
Absolutely.
And let me give you an example. When I first started, young Skippy Q.
Oh, Skippy Q.
CBR 600 F2, College Station, Texas.
Dang.
19 years old. And all of a sudden, I had a bike that had adjustable spring preload on the front coming from a VTR 250, which had nothing. So I crank down on the little adjusters, and it's just spring preload. These forks are something called damper rod suspension. They're old school. That you can't, nothing like anything.
I don't
that
even
you
think they were inverted yet.
No, these are definitely right side up forks.
Right.
No compression or rebound. You had to put something called a Racetech Gold Valve emulator in them to get
emulator.
It would emulate a cartridge. Okay, so that was what it was called. Anyway, so I remember doing that and actually noticing it to the point where I'm like, I do not like that, right? And that just riding around
really?
Little Skippy Q in College Station, Texas, riding around on Texas Avenue, I was like, ooh, when I would turn, it didn't feel right. It like would, so I backed it off halfway, and then it got better. And then I backed it back off another turn, and then it was okay. This is just me riding little Skippy Q speed when I'm very young,
which
not
is probably
knowing
still
what
pretty
I'm doing.
Fast.
But it was noticeable that I could notice that. And then I also learned very quickly, the only real adjustment I believe on that shock was a rebound adjuster. And this often happens, especially on
not
older.
Even preload, just rebound.
Well, there's preload, and on the Honda shock, it was like the stepped mechanism. It wasn't like what you're used to seeing where you loosen a couple of threaded things and then you spin it and you could, it's almost infinite. Mm-hmm. This was, you grab the wrench and it goes clunk, one, two, three, four, maybe five, six. Oh. I don't know. Something like that. So I had played with that, got it right-ish. Again, for me at the time, probably not right in general. Wasn't using the method of setting sag, which is the normal thing. But it made a huge difference, and I did notice that. And then the first time I almost high-sided myself because I turned in the rebound on the shock too much. Because I was just fucking around. But nobody does this. Not often. Especially when you are confronted with this really complex set where you have adjusters on both sides. And maybe it says compression on one side, uh-huh. rebound on the other. Uh-huh. But not all shocks are like that. And sometimes it's compression at the bottom and not at the top and yada, 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 yada. So I get it that people are scared of it. But it's like one of the first things I try and get people to screw with. Like literally and figuratively.
Literally.
Literally.
Get your screwdriver and start turning some shit.
To a point. And the only one I tell people to just be really, 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 really careful with is the rear rebound, because that is the high side the screw. So if you're ever doing stuff like this, read about it. It's not like it's that hard. That's the thing. You're not dealing with too many different factors here. It's just that it's intimidating.
Yeah.
So get the spring preload first. That's what you're fucking with, like you're talking about and like what Dave is talking about.
Right.
But if you weigh 200 pounds or more, depending on the bike, yeah, you're probably going to have to up your spring rate. And that seems daunting because you're like, oh, man, I have to spend $100 on springs or $200 or whatever it is and then have them installed. And oh, my God, that's a freak out. And you know what I mean? But it will change
game changer.
Your bike. If you are larger than that, then that break point between 180 and 220, I guarantee you're going to have to adjust the bike and front and rear. It makes a huge difference. Please do it.
And it's interesting because if I had never gone into track riding and just rode at like spirited street,
yeah,
riding, what he had done to my bike would probably be more than enough, and I'd never have to look at new springs ever again.
Yeah, sure.
But once you get to that level where you're really working the brakes and really working the throttle.
There's a break point of speed as well.
Right.
And that once you do get fast enough where you're at that maybe 75th percentile of fast people at a track day, you then get it like knocked up even further in the, I might need stiffer springs, whatever that is.
And that's what I got out of that whole thing. God damn it.
What I'm getting out of it is, and there was an article I read, I think it's Matt Oxley, possibly. Out of all the people that you can read, there's a gentleman named Matt Oxley, and I can't remember what his website is, but it's very simple. He's been writing about MotoGP for a really long time. And the article explained Pecco's setup, at least in the later stages of last year, he was talking about how his bike absolutely goes to the end of the stroke and bottoms out.
Mm-hmm.
So the forks are bottoming out, and whatever mechanism is a bottom out, there might be a cone. I don't really know what's going on there, but frankly, it's probably just like literally all the forces in the braking zone coming up through the tire, through the wheel, through the fork, all the way up to his handlebars. Mm-hmm. And that's what he liked, which I thought was fascinating.
That is interesting.
Say, hey, this is what I like. And he's literally the best in the world at it for 2 years running.
Yeah.
So it's cool to hear that he's like, yeah, I don't really care. I don't need it to be. I just need it on the bottom. Really fascinating to hear that.
I wonder if that's makes it for him where he can read the tire better.
Whatever it is. Yeah. It gives him a feel.
Everyone's
doesn't
got
mean
their
it's
own
always
way.
Gonna be that way.
Right.
But with those tires, right? That's kind of the key, is right. that the tires they're on.
It's a dynamic situation.
And that bike, because it's obviously really good, and whatever they have, whether it's a mass damper in the rear, whatever fancy stuff that makes that bike like significantly better than the Hondas and the Yamahas or whatever, it's pretty cool. So to hear him like come up with that, and I mean, we assume it's true, but it might not be. Whatever. It's cool.
It's interesting. I'm pretty psyched to go out there and see if I still got it. It's been a while.
I'm sure you do.
You know, somewhere.
Yeah, right.
I got to find it. It's in my tracksuit downstairs.
Yeah.
Whatever it may be. What's new for you?
I guess when it was the last time we chatted, I was still doing a lot of boat and or log splitter. I've got this log splitter project that I have had to ramp up because we've got parts. So I'm fabricating parts to make a rolling, like a powered log splitter, so that you press a button and it rolls on its own through hydraulic power.
Huh.
So that if you take it to an area that's kind of loamy and gnarly,
this will just walk.
You can, yeah. It's for people. The guy that is having the engineer that I used to work with at CIS build this was like, hey, I used to rent these. I used to rent log splitters, and often the problem was that people couldn't get them to the area.
How do you get it to the spot?
So then you end up having to get your rounds and put them in a bucket, and it takes forever because you're bringing them to the splitter, and now you can do the split. So anyway, that's what I've been doing.
That's cool.
It is. It's an interesting
the splitter
thing.
For all.
It is, right? Little grandma out there with the splitter. Maybe I'll have my mom have one.
Oh my gosh, frankly, that'd be amazing.
I could use that at my mom's property in Texas. Anyway, so doing that, and then the boat today was really interesting. I don't know if this matters, but so we have the boat that we are working on has a 60-ish kilowatt hour battery, which is about the size of like a Tesla Model 3.
Okay.
So we're talking fuel tank size, essentially, right?
Okay.
60 kilowatt hours is a lot of energy, and we were at full, and I yoinked the motor off of it.
And then yeeted
the bike? Right. So I yoinked the motor to do some development stuff, but we were having some issues with the charge. So a lot of people that have Teslas and or other electric vehicles know that the state of charge and keeping the batteries kind of on the same level is a thing. But we're like, well, we need to redo that to this battery because we've cycled it a bunch of times.
Hmm.
Like, well, the only way we can do that is we need it at 10% or less state of charge. I'm like, well, what do we do about that? Because we're not going to get out on the river anytime soon and burn it down. Like, we're sorry, not burn it down. Just a bad term. Bad term. So we're not going to be able to discharge the battery. So we turned on a bunch of the DC circuit stuff on the thing, which is basically like your 12-volt system that you would have in your car that turns on the lights.
Right.
We have lights, you know, port and starboard and all this stuff.
Plug all the phones to the thing.
And then we turned on all this stuff, and it was burning like a kilowatt of energy. It would have taken like 5 days to get the state of charge.
Wow.
So we ended up one of the other guys in this facility that we're in, which is all EV drive people, which is really cool. He jokingly said, well, we should probably use the dyno and run one motor against each other and we'll fill the dyno battery up. And I'm like, well, if I have to get out of here, this is yesterday. If you want to do that, let's do it. Like, go for it. Right. I get in this morning and it was still the boat's still sitting with the lights on and the fans running and
son
a bunch
of a bitch.
And I'm like, and it was like down 10% energy. It was not even close, right? So I go to these guys, I'm like, hey, were you serious? Do you think we could do that? And then all these engineering dudes were like kind of bit into it, which was really cool to watch. Like, they were like, well, we would have to do X, Y, and Z, and we have to fake out the battery to think it's connected, and right, the HVIL has to be this, and the blah, blah, blah has to be this. And so it was really cool to watch these guys kind of come together. I'm like, put me on. What do I disconnect and reconnect, right? And so I did, and we moved the dyno over to the boat, and then we got it running. And it also was a validation for a controller. So it'd be like if you're going to validate a MoTeC ECU as opposed to Magneti Marelli ECU.
Okay.
We were essentially doing that. And we were using this as an opportunity to do that without having to go on the water. So it was really cool because we basically just had to run the motor for hours on end, building up heat and giving it like a lot of pressure to go against. So you're using one electric motor against another electric motor.
Wow.
And you take the second one and you force it against the first one because it's generating electricity. And you're putting that back into this big battery cells.
Fascinating.
And it's only about a 10% loss, maybe a little less than that, which is really cool. So 60 kilowatt hours going into another battery, it would be 54. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
So it's way better than burning it off as heat and vibration and whatever with lights
useless.
And fans. Yeah. So it was really, and so the dude that owns the dyno was super stoked because it was just a cool thing. So that's what I've been up to.
Nice.
I figured that's nerdy enough to
that's
work.
Super nerdy.
Some,
I love
some,
it.
Somebody listening to this might be, appreciate that. But I took pictures of it because I'm like, in a week and a half, I'm going to be cranking on my hog down in Daytona. And this is like.
And also helping motorcycles.
Yeah, right. And working on my Harley Davidson. So the fact that I'm going from these like completely opposite worlds, I love it. I'm actually pigging shit with it because it's just
the juxtaposition is just
it is
never ending.
It's super
hilarity
notable.
To me.
It is super notable. I mean, it was worse when I was working on my truck, but it's the exact same thing. Working
same
on
thing.
My truck or the
it's the same thing. How far off are they?
It really is literally the same. So it's really strange for me to be in this world. Yeah,
that is incredible. So in the last episode, we kind of talked a little bit about. Talking to people about picking the right motorcycle.
Yeah.
Now, we can probably look at several different segments of this, but I feel like we can centralize all of it because people are going to say, well, for a beginner or for a dirt biker or for, you know, there's this crazy diagram you can probably draw for
everybody.
Yeah,
I'm sure. You can get super complex.
Yeah. And oftentimes when people have these conversations with me and they ask, well, what bike do you think I should have? It's like they're asking me to pick the perfect bike for them.
They're like, well, what do you think I should eat
right
now?
What do you think I should eat right now? I don't even know you.
What are you hungry for?
But, right? Yeah. But as like, as you know, a quote unquote professional in the industry, I get it. They're looking for wisdom. They're looking for suggestion.
Yeah.
And maybe a little bit of like weight to take off their shoulders put you in charge of helping them pick the thing. Sure, no problem. And so, you know, I think several questions have to be asked of the buyer, of the dreamer. Like, what do you want to do? There's so many times where I look at somebody and go, you got to be honest with yourself when you ask these questions. Like, if you come to me and go, I want a Panigale.
Yeah, sorry. Let's be realistic.
Let's be realistic. Why do you want? If your answer is simply because it's sexy and I want to have a pretty thing to look at, I got an argument with you.
So this is where. So I have a bit of a thing. I told you I did. You want to hear it first,
hear it.
And then
come at me.
All right. So first and foremost, and this is just of course, is what? How much can you spend? And be
important.
Realistic.
Yeah.
So initial cost, and then how much do you think you can afford per year? You have to know that going into it, right? That starts a completely different thing than what I think a lot of people, even though they know, oh, well, I'll be okay. I'll figure out the thing is, no, if you can spend only $4,000 and you can't spend more than $500 a year, that informs a completely different use case than I have $15,000 and I'm starting from scratch and then I can spend whatever I want a year, right? It's a different thing. So that's first and foremost.
Totally.
For me, then, it is where... After how much you get, where do you want to go?
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. It's super simple. Do you want to commute? Yes. Do you want to go to the mountains? Yes. Do you want to do track days? Yes. Whatever those things are.
Right.
Start thinking about it. What do you want to do? And yeah, it can be in the end. It can be the dream level of thing to have that conversation because you've got to start somewhere. Where do you want to go? How fast do you want to get there? Right.
Important question.
So, like this is for me. That's a big how fast. Because you know what? Somebody's like, I don't care about speed at all. And this has been a new thing for me over the past few years. It's paying attention to people that ride Harleys that don't really want to go fast.
No.
Straight up.
Nope.
They're
just cruising.
I'm not being shitty. I'm straight up. If you just want to cruise, that is a different part of motorcycle lifestyle that I do not understand at all and can't really, like, it's not my jam. Like, I do not get it. So I don't. But I can talk about that. But okay, so how fast do you want to get there and how good do you want to look doing it?
Which is such a...
It sounds cheesy, but it's true, right?
It's such a subjective question, right? Like,
but that's part of the deal.
Yeah, totally.
What part of it is sexy to you and how much are you willing to pay for that, right? Relative to... Because some people don't really care. They end up on a KLR 650 and they're happy. Happy as clam.
Happy as can be.
Booping along.
The KLR 650 clan lives.
They've bought the bike for $4,000. They're going to spend less than $500 a year on it.
Right.
And they're going to go anywhere, right? So if you're looking at the continuum, that's a good example of a bike that you can do anything with, right?
Thanks for listening to a Brap Talk podcast. The answer is a KLR 650.
Yeah, right. But if you want to do it fast, no. And if you want to do it good looking good, sorry. No.
How dare you, Q?
Absolute. There's nothing. I can't. Yeah, anyway, so that's a good example of the thing. If that is the path that they want, they're like, I want to be able to go to Tierra del Fuego.
Mm-hmm.
And their brand new rider is like, oh boy, there's some steps here, right? Oh, so often though, and in that with that I just laid out, is usually like, well, if you're brand new, get a dirt bike. I and then they're like, well, I don't have a way to transport. Figure it out. Like straight up, I cannot emphasize enough trying to get on dirt bikes first before getting on street bikes. And I know that's not going to happen all the time, and it's very rare that somebody could have that privilege. But if they do, if they even have an inkling of, you know, I have a friend, got somebody with some property,
right.
I have access to a mototote or
take
a trailer,
advantage.
Do it.
Yeah.
Like for me, you will learn 10 times, 100 times more about how to ride a motorcycle riding in the dirt than you will ever ride on the street and going to dirt, right? It's just the way it is.
As someone who did the exact opposite, I agree.
And same with me. When I started on dirt-ish types of bikes, but I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't ride off-road very often. So when my first bike that I rode around on was a Honda NX125, it was a dirt-capable bike with suspension travel, and it was air-cooled single, very simple machine.
Mm-hmm.
But I would take it off-road in the sand in Central Texas, and I didn't have anybody to ride with. I didn't know what I was doing, and all I cared about was Sport Rider magazine and crotch rockets.
Right.
So I would go and
sexy shiny things.
Ride that thing around corners as fast as I could because that was what I wanted, and I didn't understand the difference between the 125 that was in the magazine and the 125 that I was riding around, right?
It was basically the same, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. So that's one thing that I will say that kind of blanket covers it. Then once you get into the street bike side of it, like if they're like, well, I cannot do that, then it's basically just as small as you fucking can for as long as you can. And yes, you're going to buy a bike that you're going to grow out of. I don't care how tall you are. I don't care how old you are. Buy the smallest possible bike that you can. And know that, yes, you're going to have to get rid of it soon, but that's fine. Most of these bikes actually hold their value fairly well, like most things that are small, that are competent enough.
Yeah. Simple, small things aren't expensive to start out with, and they don't plummet.
Right. You're not going to buy, and this goes in the dirt bike world. So if somebody says, well, I'm...
Fuck it, a Grom is still like that.
Yeah. It's
they're worth more used than they are new sometimes.
And I will say this. A couple of years ago, we did the Alley Sweeper, which is coming up soon. I'll be gone, sadly, for the Alley Sweeper.
Me too. I'm so bummed.
This is where there's a bunch of alleys in Portland that are unimproved, that are in sections of town. They're like these huge swaths of blocks that go for like a mile, where between each major street are these alleyways, and they're just kind of overgrown or not overgrown.
Yeah.
Sometimes people care about them, sometimes they don't, whatever. So this one entity, the SFRC, a local club, has been putting on this Alley Sweeper. So I took Jamie, my partner, on that, and I was riding the Africa Twin, because of course, and Jamie was on a Grom, and we ended up just riding around. And you know what? No, that's not true.
No, you were both on little bikes.
That's very true. The year prior, I was the Pied Piper on the Africa Twin. Jamie wasn't involved, but this group of Groms and Benelli,
right.
The little Benelli
that's
125,
right.
were
that's
all behind right. me like a movie. It was. I really wish we had video of it, because you'd see, like, if you were on a city street and you'd see somebody go on between alleys, you'd see the brrrr, and then it was really fun. The next
incredible.
Year, then we both got on Groms because
right.
they're friends.
And you both have kind of like knobby-ish tires on them.
Yeah, both had knobbies, and Jamie had so much fun, and actually just traded my buddy who owned one of those Groms. I traded my Ninja 250 for the Grom.
Perfect.
I just haven't even ridden it because it's been wintertime.
Right.
But he was like, I want to do track days on a bike that's not my CBR 600. Here, why don't we do the swapper?
Let's do the right
so
thing here.
It is a good point. Most people will look at Groms as, I don't know, a novelty?
A toy?
And they are absolutely a legitimate thing.
Yeah.
And for somebody that doesn't necessarily have the inseam or the ability to handle a bigger machine, they're a pretty cool thing. They actually go quite well.
Yeah.
The only issue I have is that they're not very visible, and you have to be extra careful
in
traffic.
Like an 8/10 of a bike.
Yeah. So if you're in Portland, it feels fine because there's lots of scooters and most people are driving Prii. You go to where I'm from in Texas, you are swallowed whole by, like, you will be looking up at floorboards
extra large,
the extra cab, gnarly 25-inch wheel BS.
F-250, that's cute. How about F-550?
Yeah, exactly, right? So that is something that's a concern depending on where you are. So again, that goes back to where do you want to go?
Right.
So if somebody's telling me that they want to commute in Los Angeles, that's a huge difference between
massive.
I want to commute in middle America somewhere,
yeah.
Or I just want to be able to go up in the mountains on my days off. I don't want to commute. I just want to ride. That's going to inform the decision a lot more than what, you know, but deciding what you color you like or what engine you think is going to be good or whatever the thing is. You've got to be very, very honest with yourself on where you want to go.
That's the thing, right? That honest conversation that I hope every seller has with a buyer of who are you? What is your history? What is your budget? What are your needs? You know, we talk about the needs first, and it's a funny conversation to have about a motorcycle in the U.S. because you don't need
a motorcycle
in the U.S.
Yeah.
But like, what are you hoping to achieve with this thing? And if you are brand new Skippy who just wants to start riding a Panigale because you saw it on a magazine or on a forum.
You're like, hey, slow your roll. We want to get you there.
Totally.
100%. But you're not going to, we've seen this too many times, you are not going to be able to get there without hurting yourself or putting yourself in harm's way, and you will not learn as much as you would if you start small.
I remember 6 or 7 years ago, we lost a customer to another dealership because we wouldn't sell them a Panigale 1299S.
Yeah.
And they had money to buy one.
Of course, sure.
And so then they went out and bought an Aprilia RSV4.
Yeah.
It was their first motorcycle.
Yep.
They had just gotten their license. And it was like, I refuse to be a transactional place that will do that to somebody because I love this sport so much. I love this lifestyle so much. By some miracle, I survived even though it was a dumb Skippy who got on a powerful bike.
Yeah, same.
I survived it. And so it's just like, listen, man, just historically and mathematically speaking, you're going to be better off on a smaller, more friendly motorcycle.
And the fact was, you were probably trying to sell them on a whatever the 958.
Yeah, like a super sport.
Whatever.
Which is still a lot of motorcycles.
But even an 899, whatever the thing was, you wouldn't want to.
No.
But the fact that these people would see that and be like, well, it's a small bike. It's like, no.
No.
No, don't do that to yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's the thing. And oftentimes people will come with a friend or someone that's like their moral support, and that friend's got their opinions and they're oftentimes strong.
Yeah, sure.
And it's like,
no, yeah.
I've had to a couple of times put my hand on that person's face and like, hold on, you're not buying this.
Yeah.
You're not the one responsible for this. While I appreciate your opinion, it's not, you're not the one that's going to be handling stuff for this
and
person.
And you're telling this person really bad stuff.
Like just slow down.
Yeah.
The other thing we get a lot is like parents that come with their kids. Typically it's a father and a daughter. And the father is very protective and they have their ideas and they've got like their BMW R1250 GSA and, you know, oh, she should start on a something. It's like, hold on, let's talk to her.
Yeah.
What do you want? Where do you want to go with this?
Don't you automatically just talk to the guy anyway? Isn't that the
absolutely. I mean,
when there's a man and a woman come
in? That's the correct way of doing it.
It's the dude that you have to check.
You just get in front of the woman, put your back to her and start speaking to the man.
When I was at the turn two, because this is Motocorsa had the pre-owned side. And when I was over there, I made this really concentrated effort to always say to good eye contact with the woman only. So what are you here for? Or what are you looking for?
Yeah.
Whatever the thing was. And the shock, but the kind of wry smiles. I will never forget how many wry smiles of, no, we're here looking for... Okay, well, you don't ride, you don't want to, right?
Yeah.
I would push it a couple times, but then it would go. Or in the couple times that it was literally that, it was like very, it felt great.
It's poetic.
So hopefully
there's
more people that do that because that is a 10x angering holy shit thing that I see in the motorcycle industry all the time.
My God.
So,
absolutely.
So anyway, father daughter, which is interesting to hear.
It just happened. It just happened 2 days ago.
Okay, interesting, because frankly, that's awesome to hear. It's a surprise to hear that's happening.
What I loved is that dad brought daughter to the shop and was...
Is this an existing customer, though?
Nope.
Okay.
Never been to the shop before. And so, you know, he was talking about a bike for himself first. And then he goes, actually, honestly, we're here for her. She's interested in motorcycles. She really likes your brand a lot. And so I figure I'd bring her here, kind of show her some bikes I think she should get on. And as soon as that happened, I just looked at her. I'm like, what do you like? Tell me about you. Have you even started writing yet? No. Great. Can I introduce you to the Oregon MSF Safety Council? Yeah. And, you know, yeah. You should definitely get booked up on that one. And she'd already done all of her homework. I'm like, awesome. Let's have a conversation about, like, what kind of motorcycle are you interested in? And he immediately goes, well, I think she should. I'm like, hold on. You are 6'3". She is 5'4". You are like 240 plus pounds. She looks like she weighs 130 pounds maxed out. So like we have very different perspectives when it comes to this selection. I will likely at one point do a recording with Anne to talk to her about her experience because she just got back on a motorcycle after 10 years of absence. And her perspective is so unique because it's not me, right? Anything that she wants to do, I've done so many times, I don't even think about it. So I've had to find myself being quiet, patient, and just being, no, you know what? This is your thing. What is your perspective of this thing? So I had that luxury of having already sort of had this conversation with Anne. Sure. So with her, it was like, great, you've done your homework. Do you know about some of the local clubs that are here that are like very female friendly and or only female riders allowed? Do you want to know them? Is that something you're interested in? Are you more of like a, you want to ride by yourself?
Yep.
And she was super psyched to have this conversation about the whole thing. And turns out she was more interested in like a Triumph Bonneville.
Yeah.
It's just like her dad was interested in Ducatis and brought her there and kind of put that.
Sure.
That
but
thought
that's
into
an
her
easy
head.
Ish super. For you to be like, oh, well, if you're interested in that, allow me to look, show you correct. All the cool things that
so
Ducati
then I showed
has
her
that are
the,
similar.
Yeah.
Right?
I showed her the Scramblers and she just was like, gaga, full of love for the whole thing.
Sure, sure.
But again, it was
but
like...
But that's what she wanted. She wanted the cruise-ish.
Correct.
She wanted the street...
Yeah.
She but didn't dad, necessarily want to go on a GS and go... not yet, right? And that's one thing you have to tell people that are getting the motorcycle. You don't yet. You don't necessarily want to do the track day thing.
No.
Not yet.
No.
But let me tell you...
Baby steps.
I have seen pretty much everybody, as soon as they blossom a little, they're like, well, that's cool. And it could mean any one of the things we're talking about that take, unfortunately, fucking years to get good enough to be able to do, right? So if you're trying to help in this realm, I'm like, I just want to give you a few steps that will make it that much easier to eventually get on the track or get out into the mountains.
Yeah.
Like, but doing like gnarly shit, right? So I want you to be able to do those things and go see the cool things that the privileged can see.
Yeah.
But it takes longer than what you think. So just the earlier you can start, the better off you are. It's additive, right?
So in Oregon, we have, you know, this Oregon Safety Council, which is essentially our MSF group. It's a state sanctioned run.
It's called
the Oregon Safety Council.
Okay. I don't even know that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's MSF. It's just basically MSF.
Yeah, that's what all I know as
right.
MSF.
So it's
right?
the same thing.
Okay.
So they have, you know, like beginner riding, and then they have ART, which is the advanced rider training. And they go to our little favorite track, Pat's Acres, which is a super tight go-kart track.
It's a go-kart track that I've never been on.
It's
I've only
such
been
a,
to
you
the...
would love it. It's a very tight little track. And the ART is about moving your head around and getting used to taking turns, corners after corner after corner at like second gear, like slow second gear, not even like top, bottom part of it.
Sure.
So what's cool is, you know, they even tell you, hey, when you take the basic class, it is now up to you. Like, we've just taught you how to walk. Get out there and start walking and start power walking and work your way to a gentle jog. And when you get there, you ought to come back to the ART where we're going to teach you more about how to have your head on a swivel, how to hover your hand over the brake and
just kind of,
you know, the basics.
The stuff that you can then work on because you've built up your... You have already got the other stuff down, but you're going to have a tough time remembering all those things at once, right?
Right. Yeah. Because it's practice to make it second nature so you don't have to think about it. Like you said this once, when you ride your bike on the hills, you flatten them in your mind.
Yeah.
Beginners don't understand that concept, right? Beginner has their hand on the brake and has to go, okay, now I have to put my right foot off the ground, put in the rear brake
so
I can hold the bike still
and
then slowly do the clutch and throttle thing.
Right. And it just becomes, it's not rote.
It's
a
process.
And for me, it's rote so much that I can't even, I have a difficult time telling somebody how to do it. Right.
So again, in Oregon, and I hope other states do something similar to this, or at least there is same sort of resources available where beginner, ride a bit, and then like middle level advanced rider training, as they call it, and then ride a little bit more. And then maybe you find a Moto Corsa type place that has a track day, that has a C group, that's a good place for you to like go into. But what I just described in a sentence is like probably 2 years worth of riding.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Right.
And this is society. It's not gender specific, and it's not, I don't know, generationally specific. It's just the way it is. Everybody just wants the thing.
Instant gratification.
And wants it now.
Yep.
Instagram. Yep. Boom. I'm right there. I'm already here. I'm doing the thing. Look right at me. And you're like, no, sorry. It doesn't work like that. I'm sorry. It just doesn't. Right.
And it takes these conversations, right? Whether it's through a podcast or through a dealership or hopefully your group of friends that go, hey, yeah, that R1's the coolest bike on the dealership floor, but you just started riding. Let's talk about an R3.
Yeah.
Right. Like, let's just, it'll still give you that cool look of an, you know, full fairing sport bike, but like, let's work your way up the ladder into the faster, more powerful, scarier motorcycle. So back to picking the right bike. Yes, you're right. Budget is very important. And the one thing that I always tell people when it comes to budgeting is never mind the cost of buying the motorcycle. Let's talk about the maintenance of that motorcycle.
And gear.
And gear.
Right, well, off the bat.
I always tell people to shop. This is like buying a canoe. You don't just buy the canoe. You got to buy a paddle. You got to buy PFD. You got to buy blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, you got to buy the gear
alone. Like when people realize that, it, especially now with everything has inflated as it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's $2,000 easy. And that's buying like stuff that wouldn't be necessarily at Moto Corsa, right? Right.
Well, so yes and no. I kind of disagree a little bit on that. You can go to Cycle Gear or go on Revzilla and find a decent helmet for like $200 to $400 and a decent jacket that's $200 to $400
okay,
and a pair
enough.
Of gloves
right.
that are
yeah.
about
yeah,
$100
yeah.
bucks. The only like red flag I ever, not even a red flag, just a yellow flag, is if you buy cheap shit, you're going to get cheap yeah. shit performance. That doesn't mean you have to go buy the $900 Dainese jacket. It
no,
just means.
But there's an in between.
There's
you,
an in between.
You should be closer to that in between.
I have a
than
jacket downstairs
bottom.
That's from 2007. It's a good jacket. It's a great jacket. And it's lasted me that long. And it's probably got 100 plus thousand miles on it, but it's good high quality leather that I paid good money for back in the day. So that's the thing. A lot of this gear, frankly, all the gear minus your helmet is good for a long time. The helmets have a rule of thumb 5-year life cycle, and that can be argued in every way possible. But it's something that you ought to, if you're wearing it a lot, and let's say like if you're Shaheen and you're bald headed and you're sweating constantly into your helmet, you're going to want to change it after 4 or 5 years because it's just going to degrade. But the other stuff that you're going to buy, the jacket, the pants, the shoes, the gloves, as long as you've, knock on wood, not wrecked in them, they're
yeah.
probably fine.
Sure.
Hell, I've got gear that I've wrecked in and it's still fine.
Yeah, same.
So don't buy shitty cheap. And I know that this is such a privileged thing to say, but like, it's your body.
Ah, but that's the thing. From a privileged standpoint, if you look at, let's call the, it's the cost of being poor, right? So
right.
somebody will bring up, and this is often the adage was be the boots. You if you're poor and you can't afford, say, the $200 boots, but you can only afford the $50 boots, you end up then having to buy the $50 boots five times
yeah,
in the same amount of time that the $200 boots would last in the world that we would kind of understand. That's similar
yeah.
to this, right?
Yep.
There are certain helmet brands that I know, like if I could find a cheap Icon, I know it actually is going to last.
Yep.
I have seen it. I've witnessed this. So if somebody says to me, well, I can't really afford the $700 to $900 Rye or whatever,
yep.
I'd be like, you absolutely can use the safe optical clarity. The materials are good, whatever.
Yep.
But you need to have somebody that's in it to know not to buy the, I don't know, the cheap name that was,
or
whatever it is
yep.
that is really bad. Like
yep.
that will degrade very quickly. And then you're going to have to buy a new one. And you might not think it until you're not going to know until you've had this,
yeah.
that kind of mangy, nasty helmet that isn't comfortable and
itchy
doesn't
and
work
and,
after
no.
a year. Right.
No.
Then it's tough to learn those lessons though. So that's why we're here. If
yep.
you can tell people this is true. Do you need the full Zoot stuff? No, but, and this goes for the motorcycles, right? When I talked about, well, do you want to look good or do you want to go fast? Does it matter, right? Could the KLR get you there? Yeah, but do you really want a Desert X?
Right.
Yeah. So that's the where the area that they're in, right?
Right?
You have to be mindful of it. And the same goes for gear. Sorry we kind of tangentialed out there, but that straight
part
up
of it. It's part of
should
it.
Be absolutely
100%.
Considered in the cost of this. So with dirt bike stuff, I'm a little less hardcore about it. As long as you have boots and knee guards, straight up, like that's the most important. And people are like, oh,
honestly, man, that chest guard saved my. You saw me one time.
No, absolutely. You need to have all of it. Yeah. But if I, if there's anything, if somebody's just going to go ride around in a parking lot or a dirt lot,
right?
Boots and knee guards are by far and like so much more important than you would ever imagine.
Because
I have seen so many people fuck up their knees thinking, oh, it'll be fine. I'll have these big gnarly boots on. Nope, not even close. Dirt bikes, you put your feet down, you spiral fracture yourself, you will fuck your ankles twist and knees pop and it's a bad deal. But you're not going super fast. So a lot of people, even myself, when I first got into dirt bikes, I'm like, this is all I have to wear? Because I'm used to wearing full leathers. Like
full
leathers with chest protector, back protector, all this stuff, and all of a sudden I'm wearing like a sheet, right? Barely. But then I ended up with a pressure suit, which is like somebody says, get into dirt bikes. That's what I use, is this whatever you call that thing that's like under body, under armory, like
rash
thing.
Guard. I've heard, I don't know. It's
but that's what I use. But it basically has a back protector, chest protector, elbow protectors, and shoulder protectors all woven into a thing that's easy to put on and easy to deal with, instead of putting on a jersey and then having a kind of a dorky exoskeleton thing, which is fine. But they little things like that to tell people that it's easier to ride and you're more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you have to spend a little bit more money, but you'll be more comfortable.
But in the dirt bike world, is not. It's so funny. It compared to street stuff, it's so much cheaper.
It is, but like a pressure suit's not cheap. But it is cheaper than buying $1,000 leather, $2,000 leather suit with all the stuff. Yeah, sure. Right. So that's a part of it.
I think these are all very important conversations to have because it's part of the purchase program. The other conversation that we have past gear is insurance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
Some Skippy wants to go buy a used 2006
Holy
R1.
Holy crap, 18 years old?
You're fucked.
$2,500 a year minimum?
Until you hit the age of 25, your insurance is going to be expensive. And frankly, that's why you ought to be looking at a smaller motorcycle. The European countries go, hey, by the way, until the age of such and such,
yeah,
you can't
your step
like,
licensing.
Yeah,
which
it's a step
is 100% the best way to go. Japan,
and I get that someone's
Germany,
listening right now going, this is freedom.
Fuck off.
Really, seriously?
It's not free.
I appreciate your whatever the fuck that is. You've got a lot of experience under you. We're talking about new riders here.
Yeah.
Anytime I hear an experienced rider, whether it's dirt, street, bagger, or whatever it is, trying to tell some young buck to just do the thing, it's like, hold up.
It's
you've
horrible.
Paid your dues. This fucker hasn't yet.
Yeah.
And part of paying the dues is literally having to pay your fucking dues.
And guaranteed, anybody that says that is probably an abjectly shitty driver and or rider.
Probably.
Like 100%, right? We see what we see in the United States. Everybody complains about drivers. They're complaining about me because I'm driving too fast because I know what the fuck I'm doing and I can drive well. That is the slow Portland people. But generally, anybody that has driven anywhere else in the United States other than the Pacific Northwest has seen what normal drivers can be. And it's still bad, right?
Yeah.
Still, because our systems suck and it's too easy to get trained and it's too easy to get a license. And I don't like it either.
You got money? Here's a license. Right. You got money? Here's a car.
Oh, and same goes for like what you were talking about earlier. You got money? You can have a Panigale 12-9 or whatever the thing
whatever.
Is. So I got to watch that back to that. When I was working at Burt's Motorcycle Mall.
Holy shit, Burt's Mega Mall.
And Covina, California, at the time it was in Azusa.
Dang.
And I watched as a probably 19-year-old, I was there, a little young, full on Skippy. There I'm with my F2, watching the people that would come through and buy whatever. And I was getting frustrated because I was seeing these people that were buying really bad, fast, gnarly, big bikes as young people. And I actually confronted one of the sales guys one time. It was Matt Sadowski's brother. So there's a racer named Sadowski that passed away within the past couple of years. He won the Daytona. He was a really cool guy. Well, his brother worked there. And I had this conversation with him. I'm like, dude, do you not like have an inkling of like, why are you? He's like, Q, you can only try so much.
Yep.
I have to make my money. If somebody is so adamant that they want that Gixxer 1100, because at the time that was what it was,
of course.
Instead of buying a GS550 or GS500, I can only go so far. Yes, I want to keep people safe, but if they're going to go somewhere else, it's my food on the table.
Right.
I need to sell this bike.
Right.
So his point was kind of like societally, we have created this instant gratification. This was 30 years ago.
This was then.
Right? And it's just as bad now. It always is going to be because there's the egos and the, I need to look cool in front of my friends or whatever the thing is that people think they need to do. Yep. And we watch it over and over and over. Those people get on a bike, either crash or have issues or don't have a problem, and then they leave the industry. And often, right? Especially if they crash. They're like, well, that's too much. Their ego can't take it. They can't swallow it. Put their tail behind their legs and go buy a smaller bike, they just leave.
Or just get out of it. Yeah. Right. They just get out of it altogether, talk shit about it afterwards, going, motorcycles aren't
It's dangerous.
Aren't safe. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? We used to read the magazines and they would always have the brightest, most fun motorcycles. And the complaint that I used to have is all the money, all the design R&D goes towards the super bikes and the big everything. And the 250s back then and the 300,
it sucked. It wasn't
just
good.
We're not sexy.
But it has gotten really good right now.
So much better.
There's a smorgasbord of like everybody can buy a bike that's a smaller bike and it's really good right now.
I've literally sent people away from my dealership to go buy a Rebel.
Yeah.
Because if you are 5 foot three,
you
and you're
have
a brand new
choice,
rider and you have to have your feet on the ground planted, I don't have anything in my shop for you. Sorry. You know, I sell a motorcycle brand that the lowest seat height is like 30 inches. So, you know, it's that's called being honest with somebody and going, hold on, yes, I want you to buy one of these things. But in order for you to get to the point where you're comfortable enough to sit on that scrambler and feel good about it, you have to go do other things. You got to do these side quests. And then you can come here and have the big bad boss fight, right? So, yeah, I mean, like insurance, for instance, as I was getting on there, like even if you're not a skippy, if you're a 30-year-old who's looking at like one brand versus other, sometimes insurance is higher or lower on that brand, depending on where you live and what the circumstances are.
Yeah.
For us here in the Pacific Northwest, for some reason, a Ducati is less to insure than, say, a CBR 1000.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I did the homework back when the R1M had come out.
Yeah.
I called State Farm and I was like, hey, for me, as a 36-year-old at the time, if I'm going to buy a Panigale 1299S versus an R1M, because they were priced pretty similarly at around $25,000, what am I looking at insurance? And they were like, okay, an R1M, and they look it up, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, okay, on this bike, you're going to be around $2,200. I'm like, for what? She's like, for the year. I'm like, holy shit. Okay, how about a Panigale? And she did the math, and it was like, oh, this one's like $980.
It's because there's an assumption that you're taste and or the higher cost, well, even though they seem like they're the same cost, perhaps this is why I always rationalize it, the BMW Ducati.
Yeah,
they just assume that you're,
I mean, I think probably historically the demographic that's buying, say, a Ducati is probably not going to buy it and just huck it down the street.
It would have been. Right. I would have said that was probably true in the 90s, early 2000s. Now it's pretty much free for all.
Now it's free for all, right?
But they don't know that.
They don't.
And they're going off of data that says,
right.
And maybe their data still says that.
Probably
that
still
generally,
is.
Most people that buy CBRs and or Gixxers or whatever are going to yeet and yoink themselves all over the place. And the Ducati, because you're like precious about it a little bit more, maybe they won't. Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that was the one thing that I found out. And I remember talking to a client like, hey, I know you're looking at the R1M and this, but I did some homework for you. And if you don't believe me, call the insurance people. And they did. They're like, well, that's a budgetary difference. I'm like, yeah.
That's payments. That's multiple payments
right.
a year. Like, fuck yeah.
So that makes a big difference,
awesome.
Only, right?
Yeah, sure.
So these are questions that you should ask yourself. Like, what's my budget all around? What do I want to do? Do I like dirt? Frankly, most beginners, when they get into it, when I have this question of what kind of bike do you like? They're all shoulders. Like, I don't know.
That's the thing.
I don't know.
So then you have the opportunity to guide them and say, hey, in this situation, if you want to be proficient, that dirt bike looks goofy and you might not want to do that because you want this street thing. But if you can get proficient at that, you will then be that much better off once you get into this realm. So that's my recommendation, to try that. And then if you have the means, have both. Straight up, have your TTR 125 and a moto tote, and then buy the Scrambler 800. And then you could probably, at the same time, parallel, learn how to ride, get used to the whole thing if you have the privilege. You absolutely should do that, right?
It's funny. We had a conversation at the shop with the salespeople. Todd, our sort of senior sales guy, he said it kind of being funny that there is no such thing as the one right motorcycle.
Yeah, no,
like,
absolutely.
The right
not.
Motorcycle is a handful of bikes for the right jobs.
Absolutely, sure.
If you ever buy one thing to do multiple things, the truth of it is you are compromising on multiple points.
Yeah, somehow, some way.
You're going to end up with a bike that does everything okay, but nothing well. I think that's changing a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But if you want to go do track days and ride fast through the canyons and you live in Southern California, probably a Desert X or a T700 are not your answer.
Yeah, but they're not as far off as they would have been.
They're not. Back in the day, they weren't.
I could literally do that on my Africa Twin now.
You could.
Now, you're right, though. If somebody really wants to do the thing on a track, it's not the right way. But
you want 17-inch
it
wheels,
is surprising how fast you can ride all of the... Even GSs 30 years ago, they were surprisingly good on the road.
Yeah.
Like, surprisingly good. But a lot of people, they have the blinders on and say, well, it's big and it's gnarly and it has this size of wheels, so you can't go fast. Yet, there they were, the people that could rail on that type of bike.
So I try to send most beginner bikers, I assume that they don't have the privilege to have a dirt bike.
Yeah.
So I try to send them down the path of the standard motorcycle. Get a standard, sit upright.
Yep.
Hands are in front of you, feet are under you, yep. You're looking straight forward. You have optimum riding position, and this will help you learn how to ride a motorcycle efficiently. And then as you ride and as you make friends with a group that might influence you one way or another, then you can kind of offshoot and become a bagger daddy or a, you know, adventure dude.
Am
or
I a bagger daddy?
You're bagger daddy adjacent at the very least.
Okay. I guess I need to have one, but I guess I'm adjacent because I work on them.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're like the guy that makes the bagger daddy go.
Oh, yeah. I want to make all the bagger daddies go.
I'm here for your bagger daddy needs. So I think that's what the ultimate answer for most beginners is, hey, if you don't know, let's take you down the standard path. And there's a fuck ton of options in the standard path, especially in the smaller bike in this, you know, size, sub 400cc.
Yeah.
There's tons of options.
Yeah.
If you want to go European, there is Triumph and KTM. If you want to go Japanese, there's just a fuckload of answers. If you want a Harley, just hold up.
Yeah.
You got no answers yet.
Well, yeah, not that are good.
I mean, so, the Sportster, they used to make the Sportster 80 something.
Yeah, but now the Sportster is like a fire breather, it whatever that
Well,
thing
the S,
is.
The 1200S.
Whatever that would, I mean, they're
I
fast.
I have a weird love for that bike.
I don't really care either way. It's like, yeah, whatever. But bottom line is, I feel
pleasure.
Like we're a bit preaching to the choir because most of the people that are into this podcast probably are not beginners. But my point for having this conversation was so that the people listening are a little
preach.
Bit more informed to get more people into the
Absolutely.
Industry can be like, oh, that might be the way, whatever it is, if they gleaned some aspect of this conversation, that's the hope. That's my hope for the takeaway from this is if somebody's coming in, be careful. Don't. Have this process. Be ready to have that process to chat with somebody and just don't let them go wild because what will happen, as I've watched over and over and over, is somebody gets in, they have a bad experience, and they leave, and I don't like it.
Yeah, no, I don't want that. And I think what I would tell our listeners is as you have these conversations, be cognizant of not just importing your own opinions into it.
Yeah, sure.
Just help them.
It's difficult.
It is. It is so difficult.
Like, nobody would be riding KLRs. Or everybody would be riding KLRs.
Everybody would be riding If you want to ride an adventure bike, you have to ride a KLR first. I need you to pass that test. And if you become a long-term KLR rider, then we know it's a fetish. But
you'll be fiddling your doohickey for
years
on end.
You're going to bebopping the boop-boop.
The beep-boop.
The beep-boop. I think that's the name of this episode, the beep-boop. Okay, so I think we've beaten that donkey to death. Okay, so we got an email that was very interesting.
Okay, let's go for it.
I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's a lot. In fact, at some point, the dear writer, I will. He's an awesome dude. I've met this guy at the Tour Tech Rally. One of the nicest people from the north, from our northern neighbors in Canada.
The Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about? Hoser.
Sorry. I didn't mean to.
Sorry.
Right.
Sorry.
Boy, we're going to get some hate mail. But the hate mail is going to be like, guys, that's not nice.
I like the prospect of that.
I love the prospect of that. So this is coming from Martin. Martin's awesome. I've met him a couple of times. He wrote a diatribe here. And then he even wrote at one point, I need to blah, 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 blah. He wrote in the third paragraph. We're in the third paragraph. I hear Quentin asking me to get to the point. So here we are.
Do I come across as a person that
you know? Even if you're not, we're going to believe you are.
Okay, but no, I know I would, but at the same time, not really. I'm usually interested.
I hear Monty Python in my head, like, get on with it. So we talked about, I guess in episode 94, we talked about like quad lock phone mounts. Regardless of what our friend here, Martin says, I don't necessarily agree with him, but he makes an interesting point. So let me get to his point. Because after he said he wants to get to the point, he made some more comments.
On and on.
Marty's got feelings,
and
okay?
And then.
No more and then. So what he's saying is that he thinks that quad locks, or any sort of, I guess, like a phone mount,
That locks your phone
to the vehicle is objectively unsafe. Now this is coming from someone who works in the insurance industry. Uh-huh. So he's given us his background. Yeah, okay. That's what he does. He works with property, industrial, automobile, motorcycle.
I'm imagining most people are probably like me, like, what?
This is
the F.
Right?
Could you ever? Because the first thing you'd be like, oh, because it's a distraction.
Right.
No.
Oh, no. So here's why he says they're unsafe. And he doesn't say they're just unsafe. He said that they are stupid unsafe. He put the S word in this. They are stupid unsafe because if you have a crash, you will be separated from your phone. In some low-speed, low-sight accidents, it may not be that far, so you might be okay and have the Bluetooth widget in your phone, which I think Marty uses, Cardo. Hell yeah, bro, me too. And you can maybe speak to the thing and go, hey, Cardo, dial 911, my fucking legs don't work, or something. Hmm. I just saw actually a video on Instagram of like this person laying on the ground and like twitching. And it's like as if they just fell off their bike. Mm. But like this awesome song is happening and they're like, what I'm listening to in my head as I can't feel my legs. So like maybe that's what's going on. But essentially the idea is that they are unsafe because if you have a crash, you're going to be separated from your phone. And if it's a big crash and you've been thrown 100 feet from your bike, you know, is the Bluetooth still going to work? Is this still going to reach it? So the issue is that if you have become separated from your motorcycle and this thing's locked to the handlebar of your favorite KLR, and you know how fast those things go, and they're probably going to get yeeted. You're going to get yeeted while it gets yoinked away from you.
Yeah, sure.
You have no longer got any kind of access to your phone to be able to say, SOS, I'm in trouble. So he's got kind of a point with that, I think.
I got nothing for you.
Here's the thing.
We've been riding for a long time, well before phones were around.
Well before.
Shit happens. I have what is the little mini thing with the little radio?
Oh, the InReach.
InReach, yes.
You don't wear that when you go to ride around town, do you?
No, but I wear it on my
shoulder.
Me too. Because, all right, so I had a situation, I don't know how many years ago it was, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Christian and I, our good friend Christian, that works for KTM,
yep.
We roll up to Diamond Mill, which is a riding area in a fairly remote area of...
It's a place where people mill for diamonds, apparently.
Yeah, they did at one point. So anyway, Diamond Mill staging area where you unload your dirt bikes and you start riding off into one of the gnarlier spots.
It is like advanced level riding.
So we pull up and a dude almost immediately, like we literally didn't have the bikes out. He's like, hey, a buddy of mine has crashed. He can't feel his legs. We need help. It was like, whoa. And so Christian and I were like, we need to go up to Lee's camp, which at the time was still open. He's like, can you guys head up? Yeah, absolutely. So we just basically, I don't think even when he had the bikes out, we literally just closed the hatch of the truck and then drove to Lee's camp and put in the, hey, mayday, right? So apparently one of the dudes that had got to this guy had an InReach and had done the initial beep boop and beep booped out.
That's what I was wondering.
And they did know that it was happening and somebody was coming. We were just a bit of a redundancy to get out there and do the thing. And that was the first time I ever really thought, because where this person crashed was a very simple, it was like one of the only trails that was basically easy. Mm-hmm. Like, but anything can happen. Came around a corner, hit a root in a weird way, spun around, hit himself in a strange way, ended up being okay. I can't remember what the situation was, but pressure, spinal pressure, something caused his, you know, because that can kind of make you feel like you can't feel your legs. He eventually was able to get out, but he did have to get taken out on a stretcher, like on a they had to pull out the crazy thing with a single wheel and the two people,
what?
One person on either end carries it.
Like a wheelbarrow, but
yeah,
for...
but within the, in the center.
Yeah.
It's the way they take propane up to the fire lookouts. I know that because one time we were at a fire lookout called Acker Rock down in Central Oregon, and we were like, I wonder how they get the fuel up here. And sure enough, here comes two people with the propane canister filled on one of these center things.
That's amazing.
So they have the means. Anyway, that's what I saw, and I was like, I need to start wearing the InReach, even for what I would consider a fairly easy ride. But we were in such a remote area.
Right.
It was only 10 minutes from the highway, but it's still... Like, if you don't have the means and you were alone, and this could have easily been anybody, this was where this crash was, anybody, anytime, could have happened.
Yeah.
And you just never know what might put you in a situation where you can't go. And if you have the InReach on your, say, I have a backpack, I always wear a hydration pack, and I have that clipped to that. And when I'm on long adventure rides, I have it clipped to that as well, where it is literally in reach. So, yeah, I guess I get that, but I'm also not going to ever worry about a phone being attached to a motorcycle and getting...
It's interesting that we're sort of in a place in life where these smartphones are just natural,
normal.
Everybody has one.
Yeah.
I think I know one person in this entire city that has a flip phone.
And
like
boy,
in my circles.
Boy, would I be tempted to, if the cameras were good enough.
Ugh.
I mean, that straight up
bring
seems
the
to be
razor
like,
back, bro.
Oh man.
So it's interesting because I have a quad lock mount on all bikes actually down there. Like I've gone so far to get the little vibey boy and then like it, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So I have it on every one of those and I've never really thought in terms of gosh, if I go down, will I have access to this?
Yeah.
To this bike. Cause
yeah.
In my head, there's every wreck is so dynamic. I can't like,
yeah.
Say, well, this category of wreck versus this category of wreck, I could be going 5 miles an hour and fall down and fucking be expired.
Yep.
And I've also gone 80 miles and I've gone down and I've just gotten up and been like, that was
dumb. Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
Just move on with my life.
Sure.
So I always wonder in my head, like, yeah, will I ever be at a point where I need to reach my phone? Maybe.
Sure.
It's an interesting point. I can't negate the point. I don't think it's a bad idea.
No.
I think from his perspective, because he's in insurance and he deals with these things all the time, categorically, the way he's talking about it, probably, yeah, it is unsafe because the thing that you need to reach out to be able to call for help is now out of your reach and you're under a bus or something like that. But it's funny in my head, I'm always so like bleak about it. Like, dude, if I'm ever in a kind of wreck where I'm in that position, I'm probably not even awake for it. I don't know that I'm going to be around.
It is kind of morbid, but it's true. Either I'm going to be in a straight up, I'm going to be in a spot where I'm not going to have any cell reception because I am often riding in the middle of these areas that we would not have cell reception. But I've also had situations.
But my InReach goes with me if I'm doing those rides.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Even if I'm on
the InReach is an absolute.
Yeah.
You absolutely need that.
So perhaps this is what we're discovering. If you're going to be in a, because part of what he wrote, you know, sort of, I don't know if Canadians have sarcasm. I feel like they do. He was like, you know, you're probably going to be in somewhere and the kids these days are more likely to film you than to call for help. I don't know if
I don't agree.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, sure.
I think, you know, that's probably a thing to tell
your
kids.
That's a BS. That's like trying to prove your point. That's
I think that's what that is.
Right?
And that's just.
Yeah, that's not.
Sure.
Let's call that a non-starter. But if it's maybe that if I was on my way, there was a point where I was on my way between two highways in Central Oregon last year, and I was in a remote spot.
Middle of nowhere.
And I ended up getting reception at a spot where it was beautiful, because often where you can see, you have line of sight of a beautiful vista.
Right.
You have line of sight of some cell tower somewhere.
Right.
Sure enough, that would say it saved my buns, but it definitely helped me avoid going further off the beaten path.
Right.
Because it verified, oh, I am on the correct road, and I will be doing, because every once in a while I will actually use the phone to guide myself instead of paper maps, which is what I had been using, right? So I would rather have the phone in front of me so that I can use it for that, or be able to disconnect it and take pictures, because I often do that, or do a little video, whatever the thing is. Way more useful in that than for me as a potential for the 0.1% that maybe I would be able to reach my phone if I'm in that dire of need. Chances are I'm going to be eviscerated and going to die anyway. I'm not really, you know what I mean? Like I get it. He's right. I saw what I just described to you, but that's why I'd have the InReach on me. I'd be like SOS, one single button. Could use my nose if I had to.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's it.
Hit it on the ground, it'll do the thing.
Yeah.
So maybe that's You know what? This episode brought to you by Garmin. I haven't given us money.
I don't even know who. It used to be Spot.
So Spot around, but Garmin sort of became the thing.
No, because there was another one, and I think it got bought by, you know, they get bought.
I wonder.
There was one that was fancy.
I mean, at this point, it's funny. I see the Garmin on so many, like, overlanding and dirt biking and motorcycling thing. The InReach thing we're talking about, if you're not familiar with it somehow, is tiny. It's like 3 by 2 inches, maybe. I don't even think it's that big. It's teeny tiny, and it comes with a little like key ring that you can attach to a carabiner or whatever on your person. And it is Bluetooth capable, so you can actually use it with your phone.
I'm not sure mine is.
Mine is like 4 years old. And
oh,
it
then
is.
Mine must be too. That's my problem. As much like anything, like even with my bike, I don't.
You're not pressing all the buttons.
I don't.
There's a lot of buttons.
I don't press. I just am like. Okay.
So here's why I'm educating people on it. So if you have the,
it's InReach, way easier to use on your phone. Apparently,
so much easier. Yeah. You actually just press your phone and it does the thing. So the touch screen on your phone.
But you have to have your phone on you, man.
And so here's what I'm saying. The phone can be sitting comfortably on a mount on a nice quad lock in front of you and you can press the things. But here's the beauty of it, because now if you're riding to middle of nowhere, Oregon, and you don't have any reception, your phone can now become the screen for the map that the InReach is letting you use. Sure. So I like the InReach because it costs like, I don't know, $350. And then you can turn the
service,
you can turn
on
the service
and off
as often as you want to.
Yeah. Which is notable, and it's like between $7 and $12 a month, which I have unfortunately kind of left it on when I probably shouldn't have, and I've had mine.
I get
for
an
years.
Email from it once in a while, like, "Hey, are you still using this?" I'm like, "Oh no, I'm not turned off, please, thank you."
Right?
So they're great. It's not that expensive. If you're like Quinn and you're out there adventuring all the time, you could probably just afford to leave it on because whatever, you're going to use it.
Maybe. Yeah, and you need it when you need it.
Fuck yeah,
you need it 100%. Absolutely.
So I would say my counterpoint to Martin is going to be, I don't know about getting rid of the phone on the mount. I use the shit out of it on
there. Yeah, sorry.
I think maybe the other thing is just get yourself an InReach. And if you're that concerned about some kid not taking care of you and taking pictures of you instead, carry their InReach with you on your person all the time, everywhere, whether you're in the middle of Vancouver, Canada, or fucking, you know, the Sahara Desert.
Or if he's that concerned, just put it in your pocket and use your Garmin or whatever. What did he use? I haven't heard of anybody actually using a.
I see them a lot. So he uses his Garmin Zumo, which is a standalone GPS
unit.
GPS unit.
Which I had for years, but I still don't like. I don't know. I don't trust them. I'm sure they're fine now.
Like Trailtech's got pretty great ones, especially for off-roading purposes.
Yeah.
It's funny. I've gotten to the point where I don't love single use objects. So I like
that's
the idea
the problem.
That my phone
I don't
can
want
do
yet that thing. I don't want that there. No. I want yet another. Some people love to have the phased array of all the various crap in front of them.
That's why they sell gull wings.
Oh man, I don't want any of it. Right?
Starship Enterprise in front of you.
Oh dude, that's
so. I'm curious, as a listener, you know, what is your thing? Do you have your phone in your pocket or in front of you? There's a lot of times if I'm riding a motorcycle that doesn't have a quad lock on there, the phone goes in my pocket, but then like my Google Maps, I can tell it to, I usually have it on quiet mode. I don't want to hear it, but if I can't see the phone, then I just put it on like, just give me heads up for the spots where I have to turn or something, or
and,
you can just have it
and
on.
And you use speakers in your, you've been doing that for a long time.
Forever.
And I had tried it and I hated it. So I don't use it. So I don't,
you are so much more pure when it comes to riding motorcycles.
It's not pure. It's just, I've tried it. I loved Dude,
didn't work for you.
I used to have a cool heads-up display for my, but it was like not an Escort, but what is a radar detector from, not Valentine 1, maybe it was an Escort.
I think it was,
Escort. And I bought this fancy freaking thing that you could put in your helmet, and it would show the different levels of red.
What?
And like, I was like, I'm into this type of stuff.
I underestimated
I
you.
Got the Scala or the Cardo or one of these stupid fucking, and I just, it doesn't sound good, and I don't, like, I don't use it, right? I stopped using it. I have it. I don't.
My buddy Joe Jackson, who actually works for Quadlock, he gave me the best hack. I went on fucking Amazon. I bought the best pair of like low profile Amazon wired headset and then the DIY ear putty thing and made my own like ear putty with the headset in it, with a little like earbuds in it.
Huh.
So now when I put those on, it's an extra step I have to take, but I put them on. Now I have like the protection from the sound with the ear putty, but it also has my earbuds in it. So I have that plugged directly to my Cardo system. And now I only turn it up like a quarter of the way and have this perfect sound in my ears.
Huh.
So I can even listen to a podcast while going 90 miles an hour on my fucking ruckus Street Fighter.
Yeah.
And I hear everything just fine. So it was like, oh, that was cool. Because you're right. The standard speakers, even on the best of the best Cardo with this JBL
something
is not that great.
No. You're having to turn it up so much that that it ends up going into a... It sounds horrible.
Yeah, so I found that like having a wired earbud that's low profile, that's in the putty, helps a bit.
It's because literally your ear, your hearing protection.
Yeah, it's my hearing protection that has earbuds in it.
And it's putty that stays in form?
Yeah.
Like once you form it once, then it's done.
Yeah, it's designed for people that don't want to have like... Because I don't love the single-use foam ones because they keep expanding. And like one ear is a different size. And
I get it.
You just put this in there and wait for like 10 minutes and it sets and you peel it out.
And then you can just reuse them. Yeah.
Can go to any motorcycle, major motorcycle event. There's always somebody there that's making those ear putties things for people. Those are much higher quality and they have various stages of
But you've earbuds. Found a hack that probably could
work. Hack costs $40.
Right. And then you could just do it again if you needed to.
Yep.
How much are the ear? The
earbuds were like $25 and the putty was like $15.
Okay.
So $40. I'm $40 into it. And it's still working great. And probably in like 6 months, I'll get new ear putty stuff and make a new fresh one. So it's not gross.
Hmm.
But it's cleanable. Like you can wash it. I clean it with like, you know, like a, what do you call it?
Isopropyl.
Towelette. Yeah. So yeah, that's I think that might be a good option if you don't enjoy the sound that's coming out of your Cardo or Senna or whatever the fuck you're using.
I love the sound that's coming out of my sweet motorcycle.
Sweet, sweet parallel twin barking at you through an Akrapovich. I'm here for it.
And I wear earplugs no matter what. And my helmets are various. I have so many different ones and they're loud or not. They're whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I wear earplugs. I just have it set up and everything.
Right. That's why when somebody talks about, oh, that helmet's loud, I'm like, oh, really? Yeah. Is it any worse?
Do you not wear earplugs?
I
probably have that look on my face, that confused look on my face when I ask people that question minimum once a month at the shop. Like, wait, so you don't wear, how do you know your helmet's loud?
Yeah.
Don't you wear earplugs? No, I hate the way they feel in my ears.
Oh.
Well, you must love tinnitus.
Wow. Bad deal. No, not even.
It's amazing if you haven't worn earplugs for you to wear it and see how much fatigue it takes.
Especially if for long rides.
Yeah.
Most people, if they're like, for me, it's about half an hour. I will not worry about it and have to put them in if it's less than half an hour. Coming over to your place, maybe, or if I'm going on the highway, because usually it's highway speeds. Like, so if I know that and I remember them and they're easy because I usually leave them in the folds of the helmet, then okay, I put them in. But anything over that, I have to have them.
Absolutely.
Like, I'll immediately freak out because then I do not want that. It makes such amazing difference in how much less stressed you are when you're stopped. It's crazy. So yeah, I highly recommend it.
I agree. 100%. Anything going on for you? You got Coda coming up next month.
Yeah, so are we gonna maybe
we'll record before then? Sure.
Well, no, it would be next week because then after that I'm gone.
Ooh.
I'm in Tejas.
Me too.
So I'll be MotoGPing it with bag OGP.
Bagger daddies.
Bag OGP. Bag OGP. I'll be bag
OG. Oh, bag OGP. I'm excited to be there. I'm excited to see you. I'm sure we'll record before then, but
yeah, sure.
In case somehow someone misses the next recording, I'll bring Brap Talk stickers with me and Safety Third stickers with me. So I hand them out to people. I'll have probably a paddock pass and go walk around and give people freebies and whatever.
That'll be great.
I like doing that shit.
So I'll be there. And then the next weekend, I'll be hanging still in Texas with mom. The next weekend is the first big Moto America where everybody is, and that's in Hotlanta.
Hotlanta.
So that'll be good. I'll be flying a little early because I'm buying an old Ford truck that is sitting at my ex-team owner's house, and I'm going to be vice grip garaging this truck, which where you go and you try and get it running and then drive it. I might be trying to get it to Texas first.
Oh,
we'll see.
My
anyway,
gosh.
That's a thing that I'm doing. So that's that.
Okay. Well, I got nothing else. Just, You know, every time I talk to you, you learn something new about something in a Harley world that's been called something funny.
Yeah.
We have Jiffy Stand. We have the Compensator.
Yeah.
Anything, anything?
I'm so glad you called that last episode Compensator, right?
And it was, it's the Compensator. It's the Compensator episode.
I'll come up with something.
All right. I'm excited for it.
All right. Yeah,
well, until then, I say safety third, make good choices, and be kind to each other. You?
Cheers.
Cheers. Fuck off. Good night.